Do you ever struggle with the question, if God is good, why is there suffering? We unpack this timeless question in a free chapter download from Why You Can Believe. It's called Why Does God Allow Suffering? And it's honest, hopeful, and deeply personal. From free will to a broken world, to the way suffering can lead us to God, this chapter will equip you with real biblical insight. Get your free download today at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources.
Good afternoon and welcome along to Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley, this Saturday afternoon here on Premier Christian Radio as part of Faith Explored, the show that brings you conversations that matter every week between Christians and non-Christians. Though today we've got a bunch of Christians joining me for, if you like, an interesting debate on politics. In fact, double the number of guests than normal. Four guests joining me for today's show. So something of a panel discussion today on the programme. We'll be getting into that very shortly. Just a reminder, if you're not familiar with Unbelievable and you'd like to find out more, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable is the show webpage. You can find past programmes, download the podcast, find more resources, including this year's Unbelievable Conference on DVD. Had a fantastic Saturday a couple of months ago with some brilliant speakers in London. If you want to download it, see it on DVD and CD, do go there. You can also find it at premier.org.uk/shop. And also links to Unbelievable the book, of course. That's been out for a little while now, but the audiobook is releasing soon. And we've got special signed copies available from our website exclusively. If you want to find out more, unbelievablebook.co.uk. It is the story of the show, why I've been doing these conversations for over 10 years now, and why, after hearing from so many atheists and skeptics, I'm still a Christian. It's my case for faith. And thanks for all those who've been sending in their thoughts and congratulations and reviews of the book. We'll be hearing a bit more about that later on. But if you do want to get hold of a copy yourself, unbelievablebook.co.uk. Later on today's show, after we've heard the discussion today, I'm going to be joined by Sky Jatani. He's a religious commentator out in the USA. He's also an author and a pastor, and he's got a fantastic new book out. I'll be talking to him about that towards the end of today's show. And we'll be announcing the winners of some signed copies of Alistair McGrath's new book, The Great Mystery, telling us what they believe is the meaning of life. That was what I asked you to email in with to win a signed copy of the book. We'll be hearing about that a little later on too. Lots to look forward to this Saturday afternoon here on Unbelievable. Hope you can stay with us. Let's get into today's discussion. You're unbelievable. Well, today on Unbelievable, we're talking about the politics of UK and US Christians. How do they vote and why? Well, it's no secret that white evangelical voters in the USA had a large hand in the election of Donald Trump to the US presidency. And of course, the traditional so-called religious right in the USA has favoured the Republican Party. But voting habits among evangelical Christians in the UK aren't so easily categorised. In a new book, Political and Religious Identities of British Evangelicals, Professor Andrea Hatcher shows why British evangelicals, unlike their American counterparts, who are known for their extensive involvement in party politics, have no discernible ideological or partisan orientation. She's going to be talking about the book today. And joining us for this conversation are journalist and broadcaster Andy Walton. Andy Flanagan also joins us. He's involved in the leadership of Christians in politics here in the UK and is the director of Christians on the Left. And John Smirak is an editor of The Stream, a popular conservative opinion website on faith and politics in the USA. He's also the author of the book The Politically Incorrect Guide to Catholicism. And so today on the programme, we've not got exactly a particular issue at debate, but we're actually going to be talking generally about the political habits of evangelicals in the UK and USA, which is entirely appropriate because we've got a large audience, obviously, on radio and podcast of Unbelievable here in the UK, but also in the USA. And very frequently, the issues between the two are often mentioned in the feedback to certain programmes. We do sometimes do political debate here on the programme. So a very warm welcome to everyone. I'll start first of all with you, Andrea, because we were able to put this programme together at relatively short notice when we heard you're over. So when did you start doing this research into the political habits of evangelicals in the UK in particular?
So Justin, thanks first of all for the invitation to be here and speak with you. today. I wrote this book because I soon discovered as I started traveling here that my observations of British evangelicals did not match my research or experiences with American evangelicals. I recall very vividly on my first trip here to London, thinking that I was going to a Sunday morning service at this staid classical Anglican church. And as I approached this stone edifice, I heard music coming from behind the heavy wooden doors, and it was not the organ that I expected to hear. It was some Chris Tomlin chorus, and I thought, hang on, there's something oddly familiar here. And so after observing a service, participating in a service, I found that the religious practice, the religious doctrine, the sermon was very much like what I would hear in any evangelical church in the U.S., but there was something different, I noticed in subsequent visits. No sort of language of politics, of taking our country back, the usual language of American evangelicals. And so that's what started me on this multi-year study of British evangelicals, to assess the differences.
You're obviously American yourself.
Yes.
And in a sense, it's interesting that you've decided to come over the pond to look at the differences that do exist, obviously, with the UK. Because as you say, not that much difference in terms of the religious beliefs, the doctrinal sort of part of what Christians. But you see this wide chasm in terms of their kind of political affiliations, which are a lot more, in a sense, difficult to tie down with UK.
Absolutely. And that was the first thing I established in my research, that in fact we were religiously talking about the same thing. So for there to even be a case to compare, I had to establish that we were talking about a similar religious group here. And that was my initial area of interest, particularly the diffusion aspects, you know, singing the same songs, having many of the same ministers in respective churches. And so I'm very confident that we are talking about evangelicalism as a religious faith, as a religious family, the same in the U.S., the same in Britain. The breakdown occurs in how that religious faith manifests in their public life.
Okay. Andy Flanagan joins us via Skype. Andy, thanks for being with us on the program today. You're obviously very involved in politics. You started out actually sort of as a doctor, then became a worship leader. Now you're involved in Christians and politics and Christians on the left. Do you think that there are lessons in any way that our American counterparts could learn, or vice versa, when it comes to our engagement with politics? We've had just a year, really, of political earthquakes in one way or another. I'd just be interested in whether you think, I don't know, do you feel like Christians are engaged in the kind of way they need to be in politics at the moment?
Great to be with you, Justin.
It's great to have you.
Great to be with Andrea and John and Andy as well. Hi, folks. How are you doing?
Hi.
I think the transatlantic interaction that we're having, I think, is incredibly healthy. I think the body of Christ worldwide, I think we're designed to learn from each other. I think all of us in every subculture, we've all got our blind spots. We've all got our presumptions. We've all got, whether it's a national thing or whether it's a subcultural thing, whether it's the world of economics or whether it's the world of business or the world of advertising, all those areas have their glories and their blind spots. And, you know, whether you live in the UK or the US, there are our glories, but there are also our blind spots that grow up culturally, and we can't avoid that. And that's why we're not meant to do this alone. That's why we're meant to work together in the body of Christ and learn from one another. And I think at times, as we build relationship, yes, challenge one another, but to do that in love. I think the problem with our current context, I think one of the huge problems is that, especially with the advent of social media, of which Andy Walton, who's on the panel, is a great proponent of doing it well, but sadly there's a huge percentage of folks who don't do it well and who don't use social media in a way that's relational. And therefore, you do get kind of stone throwing going on in various directions without actually the relationship building, without that trust building that happens. I've been privileged to do quite a lot of traveling in the U.S. in various parts of the U.S. where, you know, being asked to speak or being asked to sing in various places. And you often find that once you've built relationship and you've found common ground with folks, you know, and you'll then, you know, in maybe the second or third or fourth conversation, you'll find that actually we do differ on various issues. But actually the relationships have been built and there's a solid foundation and there's trust, which means we're not lobbing stones at one another.
Yeah. Tell us, before we get into introduce my other guests, Andy and John, about Movement Day, Andy, because I know you're quite involved in this. It's a big event coming up later in the year, but one which is very much about integrating the church in all areas of life and culture and politics and so on. Do you want to just give us a brief outline of what it is you're involved in there?
Movement Day is happening, a large event in Westminster Central Hall on October the 6th and 7th. People want to find out more detail, go to movementday.uk, www.movementday.uk. But it's arisen because of the incredible spread of Christians and churches coming together all across the UK, a movement really growing of folks who are coming together in towns who, to be honest, used to come together to do their unity service once a year, and it was never a very satisfying experience because 15 different types of churches in Bedford, say, would come together, and it was never a very satisfying experience because you'd put on a service to keep everybody happy. You know, you do a song to keep that lot happy, and you do some liturgy to keep those folks happy, and you'd interview somebody else to keep that lot happy. And it was very piecemeal, and nobody really enjoyed it. But when those same churches in the last 15, 20 years have come together in mission, in unity, they've found unity, real unity, and they've built relationship in mission and all the missional projects that have been involved in. People coming together to do healing on the streets, people coming together to pray for people, people coming together to run food banks. As folks have worked together in mission, it's incredible to see the relationships that have built. And these town-wide, city-wide movements of unity and prayer have started to find one another and are wanting to encourage one another and come together. But something they're realizing as they desire to see the transformation of their localities and their cities, they're realizing it's impossible to just do that with it from within the four walls of a church building. And so we're exploring how those folks involved in those movements can release their people to impact the spheres, what we call, you know, the spheres of culture, you know, education, the media, the arts, politics, business. And on the Saturday, on the second day of the conference, we'll actually be getting together in those spheres, Christians who are involved in those spheres, to pray His will be done, to pray His kingdom come, and to think about and support one another, how we can better support people involved in those spheres, because the church hasn't always been good at releasing people to be involved. And I think, you know, at the end of the day, much of our resourcing in the church still goes towards putting on the best show possible on the Sunday morning, rather than resourcing our people best to be salt and light in the midst of some of the spheres that they exist.
Yeah.
Well, whether that's in their business life, whether that's in teaching, whether that's when they're at home. And so it's a coming together of people who are discovering this and seeing that these cross together, you know, unity movements across the different churches could be the way for these things to work. You know, in any given small church of 100 people, there's probably two or three into education, three or four who are into politics, five or six who are into media. But across the 20 churches in a town, you would actually have a critical mass. There wouldn't be the critical mass in one congregation, but as we come together, there actually would be the critical mass for folks to come together and pray, hold each other accountable and support one another. And that's happening in various places across the country in dotted examples. But we believe that could be a movement growing that would actually see transformation in our cities.
Sounds very exciting. So, again, it's happening on what date in October again?
The 6th and the 7th of October.
6th and 7th of October, and just look for Movement Day online and you'll find out more about it.
Movementday.uk.
Movementday.uk. Thank you, Andy, for joining us on the programme today. John Zmirak joins us on the line as well. John, welcome along to the programme. You've got up super early to join us for today's recording. John, you're from The Stream. You're an editor of that. I mean, generally, would you describe yourself, John, as sort of representing a more, I guess, right-wing or conservative approach to politics and faith and so on?
Yeah, I would say that. And it's interesting, the founder of The Stream is James Robison. He's a TV minister. He originally was did rallies and revivals. He was a youth minister recruited by Billy Graham, and he's an incredibly gifted speaker. But he did ministry and revivals for 25 years, I believe, before he entered politics at all. But he helped organize the meeting of then-candidate Ronald Reagan with the leaders of evangelical churches in, I think it was 1979. And that was the beginning of the religious right, because up until then, churches were almost entirely apolitical in America, with a few exceptions, especially black churches. So I worked for the man who helped kind of steer the creation of the religious right as it existed and as it still exists now here in America. I think it's interesting to me when I read about British politics that the party that resonates most with me with a political tendency I would understand is the DUP, the Democratic Unionists of Northern Ireland. Now, I'm a Catholic myself, but just reading about the DUP, I thought, well, I would join that if I were in England.
That's an interesting one. Obviously, we've had a fair amount of our own political earthquakes in the last year or so with the vote to leave the European Union, and then obviously this most recent election that was called and was something of a disaster really for the Conservative Party, a resurgence really in a sense of possibly our most socialist leader yet in Jeremy Corbyn. From your point of view, you've got no qualms, John, about Christians and churches even advocating for particular political parties and particular political ideologies or platforms.
Well, I think it's urgent at the moment because the freedom of the churches is under attack in many countries around the world. So, I write about the Christians in Syria and the Christians in Iraq. For people like that, it's overwhelmingly obvious that they need to be involved in politics. Heck, they need to be involved in fighting and direct military operations. Depending on how hostile the culture is to the freedom of the churches and how powerful the government is and how much the government is being used to displace, interfere with, distort, or restrict the activities of the church that are legitimate, that are historically its sphere, all those things would dictate to what degree the church would need to be involved in politics. So if you're in a period of time where the government is not repressing the church, it's not promoting alien values, it's not restricting the behavior of Christians, well, then I think the political involvement could be different. But I think right now it's fairly urgent that if we want to retain our freedom and if we want to promote the values that we see emerging from 2,000 years of Christian tradition and Scripture, we really don't have any choice. There's no option of quietism.
Okay, thank you for joining us today on the programme. And finally, we've got more, about double the amount of guests that I'd normally have on Unbelievable Today. It's a panel discussion today. Andy Walton joins us in studio as well.
Hi, Justin.
Welcome back to the programme. Andy, you don't hide your political colours very often when you're in discussions or, on Twitter or Facebook or whatever. But do you find that there is, you've seen the same thing that Andrea has identified in terms of the friendships you have across the pond with US evangelicals and the way they talk about politics and so on?
Yeah, I was fascinated by Andrew's work as soon as I came across it. We first collaborated on a report for the think tank Theos 4 or 5 years ago, in which we looked at this question of how do British evangelicals match up to American evangelicals in their partisan affiliations. And what we'd both noticed, kind of separately from either side of the pond, is the huge difference in political engagement, while a lot of the other stuff is very similar. And I started to wonder about the same thing, particularly because the British media that doesn't really understand faith, British secular media doesn't really understand faith. So what they were doing was invoking what they knew of the American religious right that John has kind of described and been proud to be part of there, and saying that's what we had here in the UK just because there were a few evangelical pressure groups and a few kind of what you might call fairly mild campaigns going on alongside those. And yeah, I've been fascinated to see the difference ever since, and I'm really delighted that Andrea's books coming out, because I think every editor of every major newspaper, every broadcaster should have it shoved under their nose, because actually it says no, don't report what you think is happening here in the UK because you've seen a couple of episodes of The West Wing and you know that the religious right are the bad guys. Report what's actually happening, and that's what Andrea's helping us to do.
And when last time you came on actually was to talk about that particular report, which obviously you collaborated on. And your view was that there isn't in any way, in the same sense, a religious right in the UK that you might be able to identify in the USA.
Well, what's interesting was we called that report, Is There a Religious Right Emerging in Britain?
Mm.
Because we didn't want to say the UK, because we said Northern Ireland
is a kind of case of
its own. And that's why it's interesting that John should reference the DUP, and why all of a sudden the attention of the world and the rest of the British media is on Northern Ireland. Maybe Andy Flanagan can speak to this at some point. But the situation in Northern Ireland is very difficult. But if we very different. If we talk about the rest of the UK, no, there isn't a religious right, because what the religious right is the fusion of political power with a particular vision that John has described a little bit of there, of political engagement. And we just don't have it here. You only have to look at this week when we're recording the kind of debate, very swift debate over abortion and the extension of abortion rights for people from Northern Ireland to the rest of the UK, and see the way that sort of swept through pretty quickly. Now, part of that is to do with how delicately our government is poised at the moment and how they don't have much political cover. But essentially, you're talking about a different thing here. Yeah.
Yeah. Coming back to you, Andrea, did you notice any kind of matching up of evangelicals with any particular parties, or was it literally kind of spread quite widely across all the different parties?
None whatsoever. And in direct answer to your question, a plurality of evangelicals that I found have no political affiliation, claim no partisan identity. Those who do are just as likely to be conservative as they are Labour or Lib Dem or anything else. Getting back to the point that Andy Walton and John was making, not only have secular media internalized the American model of the Christian right as being the trend here, evangelicals, British evangelicals themselves have internalized that.
That's interesting.
So my study began with a series of elite interviews 5 years ago, speaking with members of parliament, clergy, activists, journalists, and the like. And then I followed that up just a couple years ago with a series of focus groups across 10 evangelical congregations in this country. And I, in as much as was possible, I had a fairly even geographic spread across denominations. So I feel confident that I'm getting at typical trends among British evangelicals. And what was fascinating, I had on a survey that I used as a prime or a prompt before each discussion, a word association game. List three words that you associate with the word evangelical. And amidst the usual terms that you would expect, Bible-believing, evangelism, things like that, a lot of words were associated with the American experience, the American Christian right, for example, judgmental, nutters. And so British evangelicals themselves have adopted the idea that evangelical simply means the American model.
Right.
And for that very reason, they have by and large rejected identifying themselves as evangelical. Hmm. So even though they are evangelical in religious doctrine, in religious practice, by any sort of measure that you want to categorize evangelicalism, they refuse, they reject, utterly reject the label.
Okay, that's really interesting. What if they have to give themselves a label, do they kind of plump for anything else?
Christian.
Just Christian.
Christian.
Even though they might be a different kind of Christian potentially.
Absolutely.
Than their...
And they recognize that they are distinct from other other Christians, but they will not adapt
that's
the label.
I mean, have you experienced that, Andy Flanagan, that Christians are loath to call themselves evangelicals because of the associations it has in the public's mind, I suppose?
Yeah, that is certainly something that I have experienced. I think, you know, on both sides, folks wanting to kind of restore and redeem what they see as being really positive about the word evangelical, and some folks who are sort of pragmatically trying to step away from it because they're aware of other people's understanding. I think what I want to maybe poke and provoke, and you know, if it's all right to disagree slightly, I think that's why we're all on a panel together. I think from my experience and from being in the States and from being in the UK, that I'm not sure I would totally go along with the thought, much as I think Andrea's research is impeccable and amazing. I'm not sure I would fully go along with the sense that actually doctrinally that we're in the same place, but we play it out in different ways. I know that's a generalization. And I think from my experience that actually we get to different models of engagement politically actually from quite different theologies and in fact quite specifically different eschatologies. I think increasingly the British church is very influenced by folks like Richard Baucom, Tom Wright, Chris Wright, writing about the breadth of the mission of God, with a sort of a holistic vision of the kingdom of God, the now and the not yet, of God's kingdom and his will breaking into the here and now, trying to bring the restoration, redemption and reconciliation of all things to himself. And that applies to all spheres of culture. As I mentioned earlier, politics, education, media, the arts. We desire to see all those things come under his will and under his sovereignty, you know, beyond the point of where they are now, knowing that in one day those things all will be perfected. But that eschatology of what you might call an inaugurated eschatology of seeing heaven, God's will be done on earth as in heaven, and that when we look forward to the end of all things, that there will be a new heaven and a new earth, and that we are, you know, the direction is God coming to make his dwelling with man, as it says in Revelation, and not us escaping this place to a disembodied heaven, but actually a new heavens and a new earth. That is the driving force of folks in the active missional church in the UK at the moment. And therefore, they do want to see action on poverty. They do want to see action on the environment. They do want to see action on abortion. They do want to see action, but it's across the breadth of society, and therefore they want to be politically engaged, as opposed to probably where we were maybe 25, 30 years ago, when we were mostly politically engaged when somebody came knocking at our door on issues that mattered to us, what we thought were our issues, religious liberty, abortion, marriage, that yes, we would be politically active in reaction to somebody challenging our turf, but we weren't being proactively engaged. And that was based on, I guess, a theology which is more about, well, actually the main job is saving souls, and my main job is to get as many people as possible
their escape
ticket for heaven, and anything that gets in the way of that. And, you know, John touched on it, and actually that the drive for political engagement is to protect the freedom of the church. And I think probably the British church has grabbed, you know, I agree that's part of it, but I think the British church has grabbed a broader vision, which is almost a vocation that, you know, if we follow a God who loves order, then we're called to image him by leading within this world, that he's really passionate about governance, but we're made in his image, as it says in Genesis, and therefore we lead and we're involved in governance for the good of all creation, not just for our protection.
And are you saying, I'll ask you just to be brief because we've got to go to a break now, Andy, but are you saying that our American counterparts maybe, are you saying they're back there where we were 25 years ago or whatever, where it is more about, you know, get them into heaven rather than the social action that you believe that we're kind of engaging with now in the UK?
I wouldn't want to say back there, because that sounds like, you know, oh, we're so far out of things. There are other things that we can absolutely learn from our American cousins, or, you know, their passion, can-do attitude, ability to stand up for the truth. I'm not going to say, I think we all have our strengths and our weaknesses, as I said right back at the start of the program. But I do think that broader take, not for a second turning away from the centrality of salvation, but saying, look, salvation, the holistic transformation of the world, is a broader thing than we had previously believed.
Okay, we're going to go to a quick break. We'll come back with John Zmierak in the next section, see what he makes of all of this. John is the editor of The Stream, a popular conservative opinion website on faith and politics in the USA. And he's going to be joining the rest of our guests, Andrea Hatcher, who's the behind the book that really forms the basis of our conversation, Political and Religious Identities of British Evangelicals. She's here in studio with Andy Walton, journalist and broadcaster, and we've also got Andy Flanagan on the line as well. Come back again in a moment's time. And we're continuing to debate the politics of UK and US Christians.
Hello and welcome to the programme that brings Christians and non-Christians together with me, Justin Brierley.
For over 10 years, as host of Unbelievable, I've listened to objections to faith from the world's leading sceptics. And the most common question I get is, how come you still believe? Unbelievable, the book, is my answer. Telling the story of the show and drawing on hundreds of conversations with atheists and Christians, I explain why I still believe Jesus is the answer to life's deepest questions. Get your copy of Unbelievable, Why After 10 Years of Talking with Atheists, I'm Still a Christian, at unbelievablebook.co.uk.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Well, today on the programme, we're talking about the politics of UK and US Christians. How do they vote and why? And it's no secret that the white evangelical voters in the USA had a large hand in the election of Donald Trump in last year's US presidential election. Traditionally, the so-called religious right in the USA has favoured the Republican Party. But voting habits among evangelical Christians in the UK aren't so easily categorised. In her new book, Political and Religious Identities of British Evangelicals, Andrea Hatcher shows why British evangelicals, unlike their American counterparts, have no discernible ideological or partisan orientation when it comes to politics. And she's joining me for this discussion with journalist and broadcaster Andy Walton. Andy Flanagan is also with us. He's part of Christians in Politics and directs Christians on the Left. And John Smirak, editor of The Stream, is also here. He's also author of The Politically Incorrect Guide to Catholicism. I mean, you're a bit of a strange fish in that sense, John. You're a Catholic, but who probably, perhaps unlike traditionally where Catholics have voted in the USA, you're a Republican-leaning person yourself. I mean, do you think that the politics is kind of changing among Christians in the USA, or does it still primarily sort of break down into the you know, Protestant evangelicals tend to vote for the Republican Party, maybe black majority church tend to be Democrat, and I understand that's where generally Catholics have tended to vote, but that may be changing. What's your take on where the actual splits lie in the USA?
Well, that changed about Catholics, I would say, 30 years ago. It began to change in a big way. I think in America, the politics and religion used to be much more fractured because both political parties had plenty of room for people with traditional religious beliefs. So my family were Democrats because my mother's family was Irish, and that basically dictated that. But with the emergence of abortion and other social issues where the government was changing, was moving the ground under our feet, where the Supreme Court of the country was telling us that we didn't even have the right to vote on a moral issue as fundamental as abortion, where the government was suddenly stepping in and being used not just to help the poor, but to promote direct political ideologies. In the 1960s, community organizing was something that the left-wing activist Saul Alinsky introduced. It was not. It said the government was not just to feed the poor, or not just to try to get them jobs. It was to get them politically organized. Well, it was organizing them in a specific direction, and some of us didn't like that direction. We thought it was destructive, and some of the churches were getting politicized in a way that we saw as kind of a messianic leftism, which we saw as giving the state a redemptive role that we really didn't think it had. And also, of course, there was the battle against communism. The fact that the Democratic Party in America we saw as being somewhat soft on the issue and becoming softer during the Cold War. And a lot of us had family members in the Eastern Bloc. My last name is Croatian. A lot of us had relatives who were being oppressed back in Eastern Europe.
So what John's outlining here, I think, Justin, is the real dividing line that we've got between the US and the UK. And John is articulating a very sort of classic religious right perspective there. And what he's saying is there's a number of hot button issues that mean that he and his fellow people who are proud to wear that religious right badge kind of have to vote Republican. And that's what's ended up with 81% of white evangelicals voting for Trump, which, despite his, you know, the fact that he's quite obviously not a professing Christian and quite obviously, you know, can't quote the Bible and all that kind of stuff, they've got behind him anyway. What John's mentioned there is a kind of partisan picking of issues. Now, I'm not dismissing that as an approach. It's an approach. Mm-hmm. But for instance, let's pick up on what he said about Saul Alinsky there. You know, in this country, the politics and the approach of Saul Alinsky has been used by churches in London and beyond to you know, launched the Living Wage campaign, which has been one of the most successful civil society campaigns ever in this country and has won hundreds of millions of pounds for deprived communities. And that was started by churches in the UK. So there is a classic dividing line between the two countries that you just wouldn't get the kind of language that John's coming out with there from a Christian leader in this country. It just wouldn't happen.
Yeah, why is that, do you think, John? Why do we tend to, I don't know, have such a different way of approaching these issues?
I don't want to try to explain Britain to the British. I'm always baffled when people disagree with me, and I hope that they'll stop soon.
Me too, John. Me too. I mean, let me give you one quick example before we move on to something else. Last time I was on the show, Justin, I remember we talked with the guy Brian Fisher from the American Family Association. He's a pretty far right kind of evangelical figure in America. Mm. And I said to him, Brian, you're talking about, you know, Christian values here. What's your position on usury? And it went silent because he clearly didn't even know what I was talking. He didn't know what usury was. Mm. You know, this is basic Christian doctrine around interest and the charging of interest and debt and that kind of thing. I'm sure you don't fit into that category. But what we're talking about in Brian's case there was there were just, you know, these two issues, abortion, same-sex marriage, everything else is off the agenda. Well, with him, it's guns and stuff as well, but do you know what I mean? So if you use this cookie-cutter mould to say that all of our political engagement is down to those two issues, you're going to end up with the sort of political engagement you get in America, and we don't have that here. I don't know if Andrea agrees.
Yeah, Andrea, agrees.
No, certainly. Just to clarify something, that a point that John made, I would say that the politicization of American evangelicals and in that I include conservative Catholics as well, that it changed not because the respective parties began excluding certain groups from their coalition, but because of a political strategy to raise the salience of certain issues on the political agenda. And that had the effect of causing ideological sorting within the political party system. And in fact, that was a deliberate political strategy in concert with a political activist by the name of Paul Weyrich and Jerry Falwell. And John has already mentioned the hugely important role of James Robison in that as well, whereby you had a partnership between religious leaders and political actors to, again, focus on issues at the time, abortion, education and textbook controversy, for example. About the same time, you had the ordinances related to gay rights in Miami that was an issue for Anita Bryant. All of those sort of coalesced around the same time and really started this creation of the Christian right in America. And so it wasn't this organic, natural happening that evangelicals or Christian conservatives awakened to the fact that their theological conservatism needed to translate into political conservatism, but it was a political strategy for political access and power by both religious actors and political actors to make that connection. Now, pertinent to my research, those ingredients are very clearly missing among British evangelicals. There's no political actor with any sort of appetite to mobilize or activate the political interest of Christian evangelicals. There is no religious leader willing to assume the Jerry Falwell type role to make the translation of the theology of evangelicals to some sort of political engagement. And in fact, I was very interested in hearing Andy Flanagan's description a moment ago. That was the most thorough explanation of a political theology that I have heard. And I certainly didn't hear it in nearly 30 hours of focus groups among my British evangelicals.
Okay. I mean, that's interesting, Andy. I mean, obviously, Andrew is saying that she doesn't necessarily didn't hear quite as obvious a kind of what you obviously feel is where evangelicals are coming from in terms of their, if there is a political element to it, they've embraced this more kind of kingdom orientated theology that you kind of put out there. And what Andrea and what John's described there in terms of the way that it works in the USA, why haven't we seen that kind of a mentality develop in the UK, would you say? Because obviously, There are, you know, to many evangelicals, whether they use the term or not, things like same-sex marriage and abortion and other things might be quite important. But why don't they take on the same kind of prominence in terms of the political influence they have that they obviously do in the USA, in your opinion, Andy?
Well, yeah, and I think those issues are important to people, but also important to them are, you know, child poverty in Britain and climate change and various other issues that you would say tip to the other side of the spectrum. And it's because of a kind of a breadth of passion across all the issues that folks realise they're not necessarily all going to fit. Different people have different passions, and we believe God calls different people to fight on different fronts. And so therefore, people who have a primary calling in one direction will perhaps join one party, and people who have a primary calling in another direction will join another party. And it's, you know, it's a privilege to be part of Christians in Politics, where we are trying to model people disagreeing well. For people who are saying, look, for us getting involved in politics, it is kingdom first and tribe second. You know, one of the reasons people don't engage in politics is because of the sort of their frustration with the tribalism and the name calling. And the kind of playing the man or woman and not the ball. And we're advocating strongly that that we want to do it probably more slowly, but we want to do it in another way, in a way where we learn to disagree well, where we learn to honour one another.
What you will see sometimes, even though in a sense the USA has a more strict, if you like, split between church and state in terms of its constitution and everything than the UK does, which obviously still has an established church. Nonetheless, you tend to see a lot more, if you like, political issues being kind of advocated for from church platforms, if you like, in the USA. And so I saw that, you know, down in, I think, Texas, one of the biggest churches in Dallas had President Trump, you know, for a special kind of Patriots Day and so on. Now, here in the UK, if a particular church heralded maybe Theresa May or someone and had something like that, I think there'd be a lot of criticism. I'm guessing this one in America has had a criticism as well anyway of that. But it seems like there's a very different kind of way in which people are willing to nail their political colours to the mast in their churches in the USA in a way that perhaps doesn't happen here. And maybe we just have churches that are filled with far more variety of political persuasion anyway. And so it's not going to be in the interest of any pastor to kind of, you know, start to bang one political drum or another. What's your take on that, Andy?
I think pastors and church leaders are very aware of that and therefore don't want to be drawn into what they would say is giving undue influence. Yes, they will express political opinions, but they'll fight shy of actually advocating for a particular political party. I'm actually in the job of encouraging pastors and church leaders to be more political, that actually, you know, that Jesus was innately political. And if we're following the one who called down so many things and who challenged so many things, then innately we have to get political. And I think referring back to what Andrea was saying, I think for so many people in the UK who are involved and are engaged, it's a very different form of engagement. It's a fact that they've been involved serving their communities. That, you know, so many people, the food banks that have sprung up all around the UK in the last few years, that have sprung up, people want to help, people want to serve, people see a need and they want to help. But they don't want to just become the nation's paramedic. They don't want to just keep going back every year to help, to put a sticking plaster when actually there are some systemic problems. They want to be part of seeing truth and justice and righteousness involved in the systems and structures of our world and of our government, rather than just, you know, presuming and waiting upon a sick system and then just helping the victims of that sick system. They know that we need to go upstream, as Archbishop Desmond Tutu said. We need to be not just pulling the bodies out of the river. We need to be going upstream to see who's pushing them in. And so it's impossible to have this discussion without the context of, you know, a global macroeconomic system that is still increasing the gap between rich and poor. And therefore, when people step into that, yes, they want to help and give first aid, but they also want to improve the way we live together and the way we're governed, in the way, you know, following the biblical pattern of things like Sabbath and Jubilee, where it wasn't just about personal generosity. It was actually systems and structures and rhythms that recognize our fallenness as human beings, recognizing that wealth and power will always trickle up to the wealthy and powerful. And therefore, we do need these rhythms and we do need these resets whereby we are reminded that we have a responsibility to one another. And I think that word power, or par, as I would say, coming from Northern Ireland, I think that underlines another subtle difference between the UK and the US, in that partly it's situational, because in the UK, the church just doesn't have the numbers to play power games. because, you know, if you turn it into a head count, we're going to lose. But actually, there's a value on relationship building and persuasion, and trying to persuade people of our way of seeing things, rather than, well, if we get the numbers, then everybody will have to agree with our way of seeing things, even if that means that they're forced into it, rather than actually coming to see that actually, you know, the Jesus way might be the way forward. But we want to persuade people of the Jesus way, rather than sort of force them into the Jesus way.
I want to come to John Zmirak, because John, I think that the UK and the US have both had a political earthquake of kinds within the last year. Ours was Brexit. You know, I don't think many people expected the vote to go the way it did a year ago, when the people voted to leave the European Union. And in the US, obviously, that's been perhaps in a similar way. Trump, you know, represented people being upset with the political status quo and whatever. Christians had, you know, quite a hand in getting Trump into power. When you last came on this program, were certainly saying that Trump was a better deal for the US than Hillary was going to be. Were you surprised, though, by the amount of support he did have? Because I got the impression that, at least at the top, evangelical leaders in the USA were somewhat split on whether he was good or he was the right person or not. So you had, you know, significant personalities like Max Lucado and Russell Moore, the Southern Baptist Commission, so on, and obviously criticising Trump quite outspokenly. And then on the other hand, you had a number of, you know, people like Eric Metaxas, yourself and others, who were championing Trump against Hillary. So why did the voters on the ground eventually go with you guys instead of the others in that way?
Well, I think they saw that the political system had become increasingly closed to them. Not just the abortion issue had been taken off the table by the courts, the marriage issue was taken off the table by the courts. On one issue after another, we saw the left in America using the unaccountable and undemocratic power of courts to take issues out of our hands altogether. And I think there we have a parallel with Brexit. The idea of European commissioners meeting in secret, making decisions that had huge impacts on British life, infuriated a certain percentage of British voters. Likewise, here in America, the idea that nine justices, or rather five justices out of nine, almost all who went to either Harvard, Yale, or Stanford, made the decisions on fundamental issues like sanctity of human life, like the structure of marriage, like religious liberty. But these things are being taken entirely away from us as voters. We might as well be serfs in medieval France. And that made us angry. I'm still kind of angry thinking about it right now. And I thank God that the churches were able to look past the real flaws and the sort of vulgar foibles of Mr. Trump in order to ensure that at least for 4 years, Christians are going to have some kind of vote, and we're going to be able to protect some of our rights getting ready for what's going to be another contentious election, and another, and another.
Andy, do you want to...
Yeah, my heart just fell at the prospect of another election. We've gone through too many here as it is, John, and we watch yours very carefully. But and again, I think we're just seeing the difference in engagement from John there. My question really to American evangelicals and conservative Catholics is, how long can you keep this mode of engagement up? There is a school of thought that says Trump is the last hurrah of the sort of success of the religious right, if you like, because the demographics are just against it. If you look at the number of Hispanic people now, both Catholics and evangelicals in the United States, there's just not the maths there for white Anglo-Saxon Protestants voting for their guy, as it were, to keep getting the White House. So there is an analogy here in the UK with black majority churches, and they've been kind of apolitical in the sense of party politics for many, many years. But then in recent decades, particularly the Conservative Party, I must say, actually has gone out of its way to build bridges with the big black majority churches. Now, you can take a cynical view of that and say it was purely about electoral natural success because black majority churches are growing, or you can say actually there's a genuine engagement there, and then, you know, maybe there's a little from column A and a little from column B. But I wonder if the Republicans need to learn from that in the United States and reach out far more beyond tokenism of saying, oh, well, we might have Marco Rubio as a vice presidential candidate next time or something, and actually say we need to engage with where the demographics are going.
Do you think it's going to change anytime soon, the political landscape, in terms of how evangelicals vote and conservative Catholics like John as well in the USA, Andrea?
In the US, I don't know that I sense any change. You know, the Christian right in the US has been proclaimed dead so many times.
It's so true. Yeah.
And yet it has a remarkable ability to resurrect itself. So
yeah, I was told by a journalist when we published our report 4 years ago, I was told by an authoritative journalist from one of the main networks, it was one of their London correspondents, he said, you're 20 years too late with this. The religious right isn't a thing anymore. And 4 years later, 81% of white evangelicals voted for Trump.
And yet Trump is hardly the candidate you would have expected to be the focal point of that movement. Even 2 years ago, that would have, people would have laughed in your face if you'd said, 81% of evangelicals are going to white evangelicals.
Very true. But it's just the culmination of the trend that I described earlier, of the formation of the Christian right, this pact between religious leaders and political actors for shared power and access. And right now, I'd say the Christian right has more direct political access than they ever have. When you have, for example, Jay Sekulow, the head of the American Center for Law and Justice, who is now one of Trump's personal lawyers with regard to the Russia investigation, and even, I think, defending some in the courts with regard to the executive order, the Muslim ban. Everything that the Christian right dreamed of, that James Robison, for example, dreamed of early on, Jerry Falwell in the late 70s, early 80s with Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan gave them lip service for their votes. And now you see direct political access. And I'm wondering where that's going to lead.
So has Trump kind of deliberately, as a token of thanks in that sense, been doing that for them? Would you say he's actually gone above and beyond many people who actually wore a more kind of perhaps authentic face?
Sure. And I would say, is this access now going to translate into policy? So it very clearly did with the seat on the Supreme Court. And I think John has been very apt in describing the thinking of American evangelicals and in casting their vote in November. Why, it was about that seat on the Supreme Court.
Andy Flanagan, Andrea talks about a pact between the church and politicians in terms of the religious right. Is that something you don't want to see happen in the UK? What's the problem with there being a kind of a quid pro quo of sorts where you do get a bit of political power to put your agenda forward?
Well, it depends if that's your only agenda. It depends if your broader agenda is seeing people come to know and love Jesus and be transformed by him and be transformative agents in the world. I think all the experience from history shows that when those pacts are made, that actually ends up turning huge numbers of people away from the kingdom. And much as I am the person who leads Christians in politics and wants Christians involved in politics, I think I've hopefully also got a bigger vision, which is about the big picture of people coming to know and love our Lord. And the problem is when you make pacts, influence, salt and light, we want that. But pacts can be dangerous because those are covenants that we might want to make with people that we should not be covenanting with, potentially. In some of what John said earlier, he talked about protecting certain rights for Christians and protecting their freedom, and that for 4 years at least they might have somebody standing up for their rights. I think our clarion call, I think certainly with Christians on the left, and I know for many of the others, for the Conservative Christian Fellowship, would hear them quote this as well, is that one of our primary calls and one of our inspirations for our vocation is that, as in the proverb, the biblical proverb, we're called to speak up for those who cannot speak for themselves, that actually we get ourselves into dead ends when, as Christians, we're just speaking up for ourselves and for our own rights, and that we are called to speak up for those who can't speak for themselves. And that means advocating on behalf of those who are not part of our movement, who are not part of the church, but advocating for everyone. And that doesn't mean we're shy about the things we believe in passionately, But we speak about those in the context of speaking up on behalf of everybody, not just fighting for our rights. If we do that, we become just another minority group.
We're going to have to go to a quick break, and we'll come back to talking to John Zmirak as well, who's joining us for today's discussion. Andrea Hatcher, Andy Walton and Andy Flanagan, my guests, as we talk in a panel discussion today on the politics of US and UK Christians. How are they voting and why? They are quite different, it turns out. And we'll conclude our discussion in a moment's time here on the show that aims to get you thinking every Saturday. Unbelievable.
If you want to have a massive reason why human beings are special, here it is. God became one.
We can be part of God's plan to bring hope to a hopeless generation.
We're living in an exciting time to be a follower of Jesus. The golden age of Christianity, ladies and gentlemen.
We live in a universe that has a story that is ultimately about love.
There's a God-shaped hole in the heart of every person. It can only be filled by God, made known through Jesus Christ.
Hear the world's leading Christian thinkers make the case for Christ at Unbelievable, the Conference 2017. Now available not only on DVD, but also as a digital download. Order online at premier.org.uk/shop.
Welcome back to the final part of today's show. We'll be concluding our conversation on politics and Christianity in just a moment's time. A reminder that if you haven't already discovered it, Unbelievable, the book available now to buy from our website, unbelievablebook.co.uk, with those exclusive signed copies of the book from our own website, the Premier website, if you're able to purchase it from there. Again, unbelievablebook.co.uk. A lovely message here from Sarah on the Facebook page. She says, Justin, I'm only a couple of chapters into the book and I'm so impressed already. You write with such an eloquent, friendly and intelligent style and make so many important points. I'm excited to read the rest of it. Well, you sent that a little while ago, Sarah, so I hope that you did enjoy the rest of the book. And thanks to all those who have been leaving similarly kind reviews on Amazon as well, and as well as tweeting me their pictures reading the book in all different parts of the world. Got one in from California just today on my Twitter feed. So thanks to all those who've been sending those in. Again, unbelievablebook.co.uk if you want to find out more about Unbelievable, the book. Still to come later on in the show, we're going to be speaking to Sky Jatani about his new book. Everyone's got books out at the moment, haven't they? A book which asks what's wrong with religion. And we'll also be finding out who won one of two signed copies of Alistair McGrath's new book. That's The Great Mystery, as you sent in your thoughts on what the meaning of life is. So we'll get to all of that. Straight after Unbelievable, on The Profile this afternoon, I'm going to be sitting down with David Hutchings and Tom McLeish. Now, they joined me on Unbelievable a few weeks ago to talk about their book, Let There Be Science. They were in discussion with Susie Sheehy, an Oxford physicist, about that. Well, this is a chance for me to talk to them in a little bit more detail about their general thesis that Christianity has really been the bedrock for scientific progress over the last several centuries. So listen out for that on The Profile, straight after Unbelievable, between 4 and 5 this afternoon, available, of course, as a podcast as well. And next week on Unbelievable, you can come back for a discussion between Glenn Scrivener and Imam Musharraf Hussain. They're going to be debating whether the Old Testament affirms the Trinity. Glenn Scrivener says it does. So look out for that on the show next week.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Well, in the final part of our discussion today, we've been asking why do UK and US Christians vote so very differently? And it's a lot to do with their past histories and just the very different nature of the way churches and politicians operate in many ways in the UK and USA. But it's been a fascinating discussion with my guest today. Andrea Hatcher, just to remind you, has been joining me in studio. She's the author of Political and Religious Identities of British Evangelicals. It's an academic work, I think it's fair to say, Andrea. Yes. But one, if anyone who's interested in this area, you know, wants to dig into it, I'm sure is replete with interesting stuff and the studies that you've carried out for that.
Academic in a good way.
Academic in a good way. Yeah.
Not in a boring way.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. But the we've also had Andy Walton in the studio here, journalist and broadcaster. Andy Flanagan of Christians in Politics and Christians on the Left. And John Zmirak, editor of The Stream, which is a conservative website on faith and politics in the USA. John, hearing what Andy had to say about his concerns over pacts made between the religious right and politics and so on. His concern is that it turns a lot of people off in the end. And I think I've heard that from a lot of the atheists and agnostics I interact with on this program, especially from the USA, who very often their biggest problem with Christianity is actually its cultural influence, the fact they feel it's kind of imposing some kind of an agenda upon them. Whether that's true or not, that's the way they feel. Is that a danger as far as you're concerned, that actually getting in bed with politics in this kind of way can actually hinder the cause of the kingdom ultimately?
Well, you know, I don't think that your friends on the left would say that they were getting in bed with atheist pro-abortion politicians when they cooperate with them to promote socialist policies. That's not the language they would use. It's a matter of, we cooperate with people who share common interests and share common goals. Constantine, the emperor, was not an ideal Christian, but the Christian church was certainly glad to see him stop persecuting the church and to see him, maybe improve things for slavery and get rid of the gladiatorial games. There are areas of overlap between a purely political agenda and a religious agenda. I think in America, well, we have a very specific kind of vision of the good that, especially on the right, was formed by the sort of Anglo-Scots Protestants. So I think if you want to understand the religious right in America, kind of look to the DUP, because that's our political DNA. The religious right in America, which now incorporates most faithful Catholics, church-going doctrinally Orthodox Catholics, our political DNA kind of comes from that Scots-Irish heritage, and I think it's a great thing. And I'm sad to hear on this show how little of it has taken root over there outside of Northern Ireland.
I mean, that sounds like he might be talking about you, Andy Walton.
Maybe.
Obviously, as far as John's concerned, if you're a Christian and you're going to be using your vote, you've got to influence it for these specific issues, which obviously are very important as far as he's concerned. Do you just think that actually we focus too much on specific issues, that these so-called hot button issues?
Well, I mean, I love to debate these things, and I love to chat with John and listen to him. I just glanced onto his Twitter account during the break there, and I saw he was retweeting Eric Metaxas, suggesting that Germany fining social media firms was akin to National Socialism. And Eric Metaxas, you've been on his show, you've interviewed him, you've been interviewed by him as well. I worry that we're into this kind of, with the religious right in the UK and with in the US, and with certain expressions that some on the fringe in the UK would like to see, we're into this Manichaean world where we are right and you are the devil. And I really worry about that. And that's why, actually, I was saying to someone earlier, I've only ever, when I've been getting rid of books, I've only ever recycled two rather than taking them to the charity shop. And I'm afraid to say one of them was Wayne Grudem's and one of them was Eric Metaxas. And that was because of their craven support for Trump. Now, just because you dislike Hillary Clinton doesn't mean that she's the devil. And just because Donald Trump might be offering the seat that you want to see on the Supreme Court doesn't mean you have to go all in with him. And I think that's what evangelicals and conservative Roman Catholics in this country have realised, that actually a more nuanced, holistic approach to political engagement that Andy Flanagan has described is what we're about here.
Andrea, it's been great to have you on the programme as well today. Thank you for joining us to talk about this book.
Thank you very much for having me.
You haven't been here to take any particular political side in this discussion. When it comes to the fact that we do seem to be living in an increasingly fractured culture and society, and I think that's especially obvious in parts of the USA as well, is there any way to kind of bridge the divide that appears to be happening between those who are advocating for a very particular vision of religion and politics in the USA and those who obviously are fighting against it as well?
So you were right to note that my research is a work of scholarship. I do close, however, with a bit of advocacy, noting certain areas where American evangelicals can learn from their British counterparts and vice versa. And I think that it's been clear that this partnership between the Republican Party and American evangelicals has yielded little beyond power and access. In terms of change of policy, it's really not been very fruitful. For example, the issues of school prayer, of abortion overturning Roe v. Wade, and if anything, we've seen a greater progressive sense in social policy with the opening of same-sex marriage. So in one sense, one could argue that the Christian right has not been very successful in that regard. Because, and far be it from me, the academic, to answer your direct, what I think is a theological-based question of what happens when one party captures evangelicals, I think it does hurt the kingdom progress, because then evangelicals are being forced to defend persons and policies that go against their doctrine. And I think that's what we're seeing, for example, with American evangelicals, with this full-hearted embrace of Donald Trump, that they are now forced to justify certain behaviors that they would not tolerate from anyone else. With that aside, I think that British evangelicals needn't fear being labeled or being cast in the mold of the American model. I think that that has had a chilling effect on their political engagement, and I think they don't need to be so fearful as to withdraw from the public square. I think there is a middle way between the American model and the current state of British evangelical engagement. I think that, as my research shows, which we didn't get a chance to speak about, there is a strong social justice imperative among British evangelicals. They are conservative on issues of sexuality, to be sure, but those issues are not salient to them. They don't rank them very highly on their political agenda. Instead, they care about issues. When I ask them what is the most important problem facing the nation today, they're concerned about poverty and inequality and food banks and human trafficking and the environment. And so those are the issues they prioritize. And I think that British society would be better served if British evangelicals took a stronger role in politics.
We're going to leave it there, but thank you very much, everyone, for being involved. John Smirak, who's been on the line from the USA, Andy Flanagan, who was also with us from Christians in Politics and Christians on the Left, and my guests in studio, Andrea Hatcher and Andy Walton. Been great to have you all with me. Again, I should mention Andrea's book available now. That's Political and Religious Identities of British Evangelicals. Make sure there are links to all of my guests from today's programme. But for the moment, thank you all for being with me.
Thank you.
Thanks, Justin.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, if you'd like to get in touch about anything you've heard on the show today, unbelievable@premier.org.uk is the place to send your emails. I know lots of people will have opinions on this, whether Christian or not, and it's probably on the divide that does exist between the way it works in the US and the UK. You can also, of course, send me your thoughts via Twitter, Facebook, and all the other methods at UnbelievableJB. For the Twitter handle for this show, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB if you want to get in touch via the Facebook page of the show. Or you can equally leave your comments underneath the latest edition of the programme on the webpage, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. And that's the place to go for more info on other aspects of the show, the resources, the Unbelievable Conference on DVD, the Unbelievable book can be accessed from there, and much more besides. I'm going to be speaking to Sky Jatani about what's wrong with religion in just a moment. But first of all, time to announce who has won one of two signed copies of Alistair McGrath's new book, The Great Mystery. We had him on the show a few weeks ago, and I announced this competition asking you to send in your thoughts on what the meaning of life is, ideally in 140 characters or less. And you've tried to do that by and large. Here's some of the entries that came in. Paul said, Jesus died, so you don't have to. Enan said, the meaning of life is love. Eric said, for me, I go back to the confessions. The chief end of man, and therefore life's meaning, is to glorify God. Marcus said, the meaning of life is to be loved by God, and it is the definitive answer. Yamil said, it is to holistically thrive daily in the best of our abilities, our relationship with God, our neighbours, and nature. Bruce said, the answer you're after is 42. Everyone knows that, don't they? A little Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy reference there. Well done, Bruce. Stephen says, I would say the meaning of life is to love God and love people. Study of Christianity said, the meaning of life is to discover whether or not that very question is meaningful at all. Nice one. Matthew Morgan. Hi, I'm hoping to win that signed copy of Alistair McGrath's book. What is the meaning of life? I'd answer to ask the question, what is the meaning of life? Similar kind of answer to the previous one there. Thank you very, very much, Matthew. Here's one from Erin, who said, I believe the meaning of life is to ensure the world we leave is that little bit better than the one we entered. Thomas said, the meaning of life lies in manifesting the image-bearing vocation God intends for humanity by becoming more like Jesus Christ each day. Very theological. And this one from Julian said, the meaning of life is simply to do what we can with the Lord's grace to fulfill our God-given purpose, whatever that may be, and as directed by him. Corey said, man's chief end is to glorify God and enjoy him forever. His secondary end is to win and read free books. Thank you. This is from Bunker, who says, I believe that life is the meaning of life. Lady Julian said it in the 15th century. Would you know your Lord's meaning in this thing? Know it well. Love was his meaning. Jonathan says, to love God, our rescuer, and love others. And Chandler says, the meaning of life is to develop relationships with believers, non-believers, the universe, and God. Boyd said, worship, now you choose what. Dave P. said, as a family, we seem to sway between talking about the same mundane things to getting very deep and often passionate about the big questions in life. We were talking about the meaning of life a while ago, and I think it can be concluded through the following. Living to enjoy yourself while leaving the world a slightly better place than when we arrived. The family approaches this from different perspectives, but the above has a shared meaning which unites us. The Christian in me does this through striving to love myself and others equally, uniting through a loving of God. And the humanist in me wants this, as I cannot bear to empower inequality or avoidable suffering. Thanks again for the programme. Thank you very much indeed, Dave. And we had further entries from other people, but the ones that actually won, and these were just drawn randomly by myself, because I didn't feel I could choose between these various interpretations of the meaning of life. One R. Pagan, I hope I've pronounced that correctly, said, what is the meaning of life? That is the very first question that I will ask when I get to meet God. And Luke said, to know God and make him known by learning to love God and our neighbour as ourselves. May not be very original, but can't think of anything better. Well, Luke, it won you a book as well. So One R. Pagan and Luke, well done, and I hope you enjoy the book as we send that out to you. Well, I'm delighted to be joined on the programme now by Skye Jatani to talk about his new book, What's Wrong with Religion? And I think it's got a long subtitle as well, Skye. What's the subtitle?
9 Things No One Told You About Faith.
There you go. Now, I'm so familiar with your voice, Skye. I feel like we know each other, even though we've never met in person, because you're one of the presenters on the Phil Vischer podcast, and that's a podcast I download regularly and listen to. But I'm also familiar with some of your writing as well. I know that probably your best-known book was With, which was hugely beneficial, I think, to me and to many others. But on this occasion, you're not just branching out into words, you're actually including pictures as well.
Yeah. Well, if you read With, you know there were some really simple stick figure drawings in there, and I got such a strong response from people about that, I decided to expand it. So the new book has a lot of illustrations that I've done myself, I'm quite proud of. But it kind of elaborates on those stick figure illustrations. And part of the reason is I've realized in a lot of the speaking and teaching I do that there are a lot of visual learners out there, and they tend to resonate with those simple back of the napkin ways of illustrating the truths of scripture. So that's why the book includes many of them.
Well, I'm all for more pictures in books. Certainly, I get to see plenty of those when I'm reading to my 2-year-old. But you don't tend to see them so much in adult books, and I think that's a great shame. But tell us a little bit about this book. I haven't had a chance to read it yet, unfortunately. It's only just out, really. But as far as I understand, it's sort of a primer, really, for anyone who wants to know about religion and life generally.
Yeah, I kind of navigate in a no man's land between the Christian subculture in the United States and the post-Christian subculture in the United States. And I meet a lot of people in the middle who are either raised in the church and still hang on to some semblance of faith, but find themselves very disillusioned with it. Or I'm encountering people who have really no history within the church or within religion, but they've grown disillusioned with their secular environment and they're looking for deeper responses. So this book was created for both of those groups in the middle, the one struggling with faith or the one struggling with a secular faith, and they want to have a deeper, better understanding of what does religion actually mean. And so some people will probably be surprised when they read this book, because in certain chapters, it sounds like I'm agreeing with the atheists and their critiques of religion. And I essentially am. I'm saying, yeah, there's a lot about the way historically human beings have engaged in religious activity that is very problematic. On the flip side, I get to a point of sharing why Jesus' approach to a relationship with God is fundamentally different, and outlining a lot of the ways that the church in its layers of bureaucracy and tradition can get in the way of that. So it's meant to be a guide for people who are disillusioned with either side, either the secular side or the culturally religious side, to show them here's kind of the essence of what we're about if we follow Christ, and cutting through all of the peripheral nonsense that gets in the way.
What would be one example of somewhere where you could, say, agree with an atheist critique of religion?
Yeah. Christopher Hitchens did a debate a number of years ago, you're probably well aware of this, with Tony Blair, where Blair was making the case that religion is worth supporting because of all the positive things that religious traditions have done throughout the world and all the charitable acts and things like that. And Christopher Hitchens pounced on him and started listing all the horrific things that have been done in the name of religion as well. And at the end of that debate, I think it was 68% of the people in the audience sided with Hitchens, that religion is actually a more negative force in the world than a benign force. And when you look at the list of horrific things done in the name of religion, it's pretty hard to disagree with Hitchens. And the reason I tend to agree with him is the way human beings have pursued religion is the same way that an organism pursues fight or flight when it's under threat. It's a system of control. So what basic human religion says is the world is a dangerous place, and the way to mitigate that danger is by seeking control. And the way we get control is either by running away from the world into these little enclaves of monasticism or safety, or you fight against the world and you get into culture wars or even literal wars in order to impose your belief system on the rest of the world. And when you look at religion that way, I tend to agree with the atheists that, yeah, it's doing a lot of harm in our world and it's doing a lot of damage. So the question is, how does the message of Jesus actually overcome that and transform it? And what I would argue is Jesus presents a vision of the world where it's fundamentally not a dangerous place, but it's a God with us world in which we are perfectly safe and not even death can ultimately do us any harm, which then liberates us to live beyond fight or flight and in a different level or plane, which is that of faith, and frees us to actually do good even to our enemies. So the superstitious perspective of human religion, sort of the historical or anthropological understanding of religion that atheists are disagreeing with, I tend to disagree with as well. And I would even argue Jesus disagrees with. It's not what we're ultimately called to.
I'd say I do meet a lot of people who say I'm spiritual but not religious.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what they mean when they say that? And do you think this book is written to them?
Yeah, I think it is written for those kinds of people. And the irony is the first chapter of the book is called Everyone is Religious. And so there's an American theologian, a more liberal theologian, but who I think got this absolutely right, named Paul Tillich, who said all human beings are religious because all human beings have something of ultimate concern. So when someone says I'm spiritual, I'm not religious, I think what they're trying to say is, well, I care about deeper things, but I don't want to be caught up in the institutional frameworks of human religion. I get that. I understand their aversion to it. But it's really not fair to say you're not religious because you have something of ultimate concern, something that you've devoted yourself to, and that makes you a religious person, even if it's not a traditional religion. So I think we need to cut through this this idea that there's spirituality without religion. It's what are you religious about and how is that framing your life? And is it leading you to be more fearful and seek more control over the world, which ultimately, ironically, makes the world more dangerous? Or is the thing you've devoted yourself to freeing you from fear and releasing you to love and serve and give in a world that needs more of that? And that's where I think the message of Jesus is so attractive, including to people who do not consider themselves religious.
And I guess if religion is something that is often used as a means of control in the world, like, I guess in your view, there are both Christians who are religious and Christians who aren't religious because they aren't expressing their faith in that way. They're, you know, they are seeking to live the life of Jesus in a way that doesn't require controlling others.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've certainly seen here in the United States recently a new form of almost fundamentalist secularism, where on college campuses, your freedom of free speech has been taken away because you're not saying things that people like. And there's a religious fervor from very secular people that are imposing their secular philosophy on everyone. And I think there's a growing aversion to that too. So any worldview, any philosophy can become a fundamentalist religion, even if there's no God involved. And I think there's a growing aversion on all sides to that. And people are going, where do we go with this? And it seems counterintuitive, but I would say to them, actually, I think what you're looking for is the message of Jesus, because he's offering something often poorly represented by those who claim his name, but it's still something that is refreshing and life-giving and answers our deepest longings. And that can actually make the world a better place rather than a more violent one. So I think if we can move past some of the historical baggage, bringing that simple message of faith that Jesus offers to all people is still a really attractive proposition. And that's what this book is seeking to do.
And tell us about the pictures, because I'm fascinated about the pictures. I haven't seen them yet, but tell us about some of these pictures.
They come in all varieties. Some of them are graphs. Some of them are stick figures. Some of them are checklists. But they're simple pictorial ways of illustrating these points. And the reason for the pictures, and some people have told me not to share this, but I will anyway. A couple years ago, I read an article that said the average American reads less than one book a year. And first of all, that could probably explain a lot of what's happening in the side of the pond. But it also means that if we have important ideas that we want to communicate, a 200-page book is only going to reach a small segment of the population. So I wrote this book. It's still, I think, deep and insightful, but I also wanted it to be kind of humorous and easily accessible. So the pictures are sometimes funny. They're very easily accessible. You can, you know, take pictures of them and share them on social media because they communicate truths in a way that it's just going to reach more people. And it makes the book an easy read and a fun read, and hopefully reaches a wider audience of people who normally are bored by a 200-page book. This book is not like that at all.
So I guess this book is for Christians who maybe feel a little bit jaded by the politics of religion, but also to seekers who are maybe open to this, if you can give them a fresh perspective.
Yeah, I think the non-Christian is going to read this and go, oh, wow, there's actually there are Christians out there who think that not every critique of religion is bad. And I think there are Christians out there who are disillusioned or frustrated with their experience of institutional Christianity, who are looking for something that just cuts through the noise and brings them back to the simple message of a communion with God that is life-giving and hopeful, that isn't caught up in a lot of the cultural and historical baggage that a lot of Christian communities have. So the book is for disillusion coming from either side.
And just remind us where people can get hold of it.
Yeah, it's available on Amazon. It's also available at whatswrongwithreligion.com. And we've been getting a lot of interest in bulk orders from schools, institutions, churches, ministries that would love to get them in mass and be able to distribute them to folks, because they've seen it as a tool that can appeal to a wide audience. And we're offering, especially if you go to whatswrongwithreligion.com, you can get them at a significant discount there. And if you purchase enough, I'd be happy to come and speak at your institution or wherever you may be located.
Would you come over to the UK if we could get enough people together?
Absolutely. I love the UK, and I'm doing a lot more international travel. So I should have come by, because I was on a long layover in London not long ago when I was flying to India. So
I would have had you on in a shot. So maybe we can make it happen again next time. But look, thank you for the book, Sky. You can find out more about it at whatswrongwithreligion.com, available also from Amazon, of course. But for the moment, thank you very much for joining me on the show today.
Thank you for having me, Justin. I love what you do and appreciate all the contribution you're making to the conversation around faith.
Thank you, Sky. And wherever you have been listening in the world, whether it's this week on Premier Christian Radio or somewhere else via your podcast, thanks for joining me on today's show. Hope you can come back for next week's program too. You're unbelievable. Evangelist Glenn Scrivener is going to be debating Musharraf Hussein on the program on whether the Old Testament affirms the Trinity or not, whether it affirms the Islamic doctrine of Tawhid, the oneness of God. That should be a really interesting discussion next week on the show. Hope you can come back for that. Here on the program that aims to get you thinking every single week. See you next time.
Lowe sabe que ahora más que nunca buscas el precio más bajo. Por eso, cuenta con nuestra garantía de precios bajos para obtener lo que necesitas a precios competitivos para tus proyectos. Y si encuentras un artículo igual a un precio más bajo que califica, te lo igualaremos. Lowe's, nosotros ayudamos, tú ahorras. Igualación de precio aplica al artículo igual con un precio actual en tiendas calificadas. Aplican términos y exclusiones. Detalles en lowes.com/garantía precios bajos.